Hi, I'm Jordan.
I'm Rocky.
And we are Playtonics. This is a podcast where we design sessions, not games.
It sure is. Every month, I say every week instead of every month. But every month, we pull something apart, whether it's a genre or a movie or a TV series or a book. Pull something apart where we want to kind of capture the sweet, juicy vibes from inside of that piece of media. And then we figure out how we can boil those vibes down and put them into a role-playing game. I think that's the essence of it, right? Get it?
Yeah,
that's the essence of it. It's literally like essence.
It is.
So, I'm going to throw it to you this week, Jordan. What are we talking about? Because I feel like this one was definitely your pitch to me, and definitely something that I know you have gotten a little bit excited about converting from one medium to another.
So this week, our topic is the seminal samurai film by Akira Kurosawa, Seven Samurai.
It is the samurai film.
The samurai film, and also the film that spawned so many tropes in film. Like, it's the progenitor film.
Yeah.
The film.
The samurai film from the samurai director. Like, it has not just one samurai, but...
How many?
Seven.
What? How do you even fit that many on screen? You couldn't fit them into a 90-minute movie? Not at all.
Oh, but Jordan, it's not a 90-minute movie. As I found out when I sat down to watch it last night, it is in fact a 3-and-a-bit-hour movie.
207 or 217 minutes, something like that.
Look, it depends whether you count the intermission.
It goes. And it goes hard and it goes long. And that's why it is such a fantastic piece of media to tease apart.
It certainly goes long, and there is certainly a lot in there. They just don't make them like they used to. It's just this fascinating little slice of like a different era of cinema history. So yeah, I'm stoked to talk about this one because I think it will probably lend itself to RPGifying very well.
Well, for those who haven't seen the film, A, highly recommend it. If you got like a spare Saturday afternoon or something, you want to chill out on the couch, sit down, watch it. It's fantastic. But if you haven't seen it, you probably actually have, is the thing. So many other media over the last 50 to 70 years have ripped off elements of this, some in whole, most in part. There's the Magnificent Seven was the Western remake that was
done. That was what I was going to mention, is like, yes, if you watch this and you've also listened to one of our first episodes, which was about Westerns, there's actually a lot that these have in common because so much of the Western genre steals from the samurai genre via this film.
Like, you've almost certainly come across the tropes that this movie has spawned. Like, a real quick recap of how it plays out is, at the start, we've got some bandits rock up to a rural village full of farmers. They know there's nothing to steal from them just yet, but they know that their barley will be ready in a couple of weeks' time. So they're like, all right, we'll come back in a couple of weeks, and then we're going to raid everything. A farmer overhears this, rushes back to town, they have a meeting, and they end up resolving to go hire a bunch of samurai, initially four, ends up being seven, spoiler alert. And then we have this whole section of the film that's about building the team. Like, something that's copied ad nauseum in every heist movie you've ever seen,
except in a heist movie it would be a montage. So like all of the in-betweeny bits would be explicitly like snipped out. You'd get through the whole recruitment thing in like 2 minutes of screen time. This is like a full third of the movie.
Once we get through like legitimately an hour and 20 minutes thereabouts of recruiting our six samurai, and then kind of happening across the seventh as he just doesn't go away, they go back to town, and then the film's story of defense begins in earnest, where they sit down and start planning. Okay, this is how many bandits we're expecting. This is the lay of the land. And they start modifying their surroundings and putting in like defenses. They train the civilians. They do a cheeky like forward raid against the bandits to try and thin their numbers. And then for the last like 40 minutes to an hour, we see the assault happen and how they are defending against it over like 2 days. It makes for such a rich tapestry to pull apart. There are plenty of RPG scenarios out there that have already like taken this format and reused it.
Yes, it is. It is a good fit. You can't watch it, or I can't watch it at least, and not see that through an RPG lens. It just, it's all very RPG coded, and I kind of love it.
So, what are the anchors? What are the things that you absolutely must have?
Yeah, what are the things that if I rocked up and you were like, we're doing Seven Samurai, or more likely, Seven Samurai but in X.
Mm-hmm. We are doing a Seven Samurai game.
Yeah, what would I be disappointed if I showed up for that game and I didn't get?
I'm going to start this one off with a brutal culling, and that's I wouldn't have that first third of the film be something that wants to play out at the table. I don't think you want to have a big chunk of your table time devoted to acquiring the quest. I just take that as a given and jump straight to the action. So in the RPG sesh, I would actually pick up some like two-thirds through the film where it's like overland journey towards the town that you're defending.
Yeah, and I think it's probably worth stating that explicitly. Mm-hmm. If I rocked up to a Seven Samurai game and I was the villager...
yeah, you are deprotagonized from the get-go.
My job was to go out and recruit people who were stronger than me. That would not spark joy. I would be like...
I reckon that could be a fun design space to play in, but that is not your archetypical game at all. Yep. We can take it for a given. You're the samurai. You're coming in to save the day. And there's got to be some level of altruism in there. Like, in the film, you're defending peasants that have very little to spare because they've already been raided. Like, they have so little resources that you're not doing it for that sake. You're doing it for, like, a personal code or because you feel bad for them. Like,
I think there's room for that to develop over the course of the game. I think if they just show up and offer you money, it still works. The peasants don't have to be broke for the setup to work. The
difficulty there is that when money is involved, it becomes a cost benefit. And like some discerning players might be like, why are we doing this for them? We could raid them and steal all of their stuff and it'd be worth more. But if you go in on moral grounds, it's much harder to question.
I feel like this is a space where there could be some different motivations between different characters. I think it's a real good opportunity to have a Han Solo mercenary with a heart of gold sort of situation. Because, yeah, I agree. By the end, they have to be doing it because they are committed and they care. Yeah, I just don't think that has to be the reason that everybody comes in.
I do think that touches on something important, though. One of the story anchors is that you have to build bonds between the characters and the townsfolk. So it's not just we are defending Faceless Town A. It's we are defending this town of like 40 villages represented by 4 quirky characters that we get to interact with and form tight connections to. And when the town suffers, those characters suffer.
Again, thinking about it from like, what would I be disappointed if I didn't get? If I rocked up and it was like, oh yeah, we're defending this like strategically important structure, but there's no people in it. I'm like...
Yeah, why does my character care about that?
Exactly. So yeah, I think you have to have a town populated with interesting characters. And I think those characters, they can't just be like texture. I think they have to be involved. They have mm-hmm. to be moving parts in the plot. Like in the movie, they have to hear things and bring information to you or make mistakes that cause, you know, defenses mm-hmm. to be breached.
I mean, what have we got in the film? We've got the old man doesn't want to leave his home on the other side of the river. So there has to be a small rescue op sent out to try and pull him back from there when the bandits come. The farmers pull out all of the armor and weapons they've stolen from defeated samurai. And that greatly upsets their defenders. There's like a real tense moment where they're like, oh yeah, we pulled up all of these spears and swords and armor. And the samurai are like, what the fuck? Did you hunt down fleeing samurai and take their stuff?
So yeah, I think we need a small but interesting and quirky cast of locals and then obviously a bunch of extras, but like a little core group of locals that we care about. We have to develop relationships with them, and they also have to be active participants in the story. Let's be real, probably by causing problems, I guess maybe also by providing assistance or providing like
wisdom or like local knowledge or something.
Yeah, or even just an impetus to like kick the story along.
Or acting as a resource, which I think works with the next point I was going to bring up, and that's the land that you're in is an integral part of it. Like,
I
think this is one where you do get to be tactical. There has to be a map. There has to be features on the map. I
absolutely want to see a map.
And the villagers have to be experts in this land.
Yeah.
So like one of the things that they do early on, they're like, oh, this is really hard to defend from all directions. So we need to flood the fields. And the villagers are like, yep, we know how to do that. That's 2 days' work.
Mm.
And they flood the fields, and that stops the horsemen from being able to ride in from that direction.
Yeah, I absolutely want to see a map. And you're right, I want to see the local knowledge brought up on that map. Because the map that they have in the movie is really more of a mud map. Like
it's just real pictorial representation.
Yeah, it's very pretty, but it's also like not, you know, a top-down grid of the village like you would expect from a D&D map. So I guess that's probably worth stating explicitly. Like this is not we need a tactical grid.
Mm-hmm.
This is like, we need a map. It doesn't have to be to scale, but it does have to sort of represent this space that you're defending.
Yeah, it shows like avenues of attack where you don't need to know that this pass is 15 feet wide and 60 feet long, but you do need to know that horsemen can get down it.
Exactly. And so the villagers can be the vector by which that information gets to you. They'll be like, oh yeah, I ride my horse down that, you know, to get to town.
Automatically I'm thinking maybe this is something that like the GM has a copy of this that's not shown to the players, and then that information is given to the players for them to draw out their own map.
Yeah, I think so. It's like, an important part of the vibe.
Almost like a legacy board game.
Yeah, kind of.
You are permanently changing the environment that you're in, and your story is writ upon the landscape. Right? So we know we need a map, and we need a spatial layout of this place.
Yep.
We know we need people to inhabit this place.
Mm-hmm.
What are the other things that we need to anchor this story? We need a force of bad guys. Like, we know baddies are coming, and we roughly know what their composition is, so we can plan for that.
Yeah, that ticking clock and knowing when they're coming is a huge part of it, because you only have a limited time to set up your defenses.
Yeah, there's lots of different ways you could defend, but you have to make best with the resource that you have in the time that you've got it. And that makes for interesting decision space. You can have real trade-offs as a player in there where you're like, do I spend the time to train them up using like making bamboo spears and teaching them how to use that? Or do I instead put them to work in flooding this area or collapsing this pass or removing the bridge, whatever it might be?
Yeah. So we've got a village. We've got a place. We've got some people who live there. We have some bad guys who are coming.
Mixed abilities.
And we know that they're coming at a particular time.
Mm-hmm.
We've got some heroes who are the players, the samurai, who have come in to defend the town.
Absolutely critical element. I honestly think that could be it.
I think there's lots of
other elements that we can add in, but I think
There's lots of stuff where I'm like, this would be a fun bit to add as a GM, but I think those are the core ones. You know, I have like, in much the same way as the movie, I have like, can you get the players to make a banner? Like, can that be part of the prep? Because the samurai design a banner, and then it becomes the standard that they raise over the town that kind of inspires everybody. There are like fun things like that where putting that in would be a really, really cool extra. But like, if it happened to not be in there, I'm not like, I wouldn't be disappointed. Mm-hmm. You know, I don't think that's a core element, the way that our people and our place and our heroes and our villains are.
I think from the GM side of the fence, you can absolutely build the session around these things, and then the rest of it is kind of up to the players. Like, once again, we say this almost every time, but I'm going to want really proactive players in this space, because I don't want to have to be the one to map out the like 200 different ways they might set up a defense. I want them to come up with these ideas themselves. It's like, oh, could we try and do something like this? And then make a judgment call straight up, like a legitimate rulings, not rules.
Mm. And I think that's where your locals do come in, because as the DM, they are your tool for nudging the players to make these decisions. So, you know, maybe if you have less proactive players who need a little coaching in that direction, it becomes a thing of like the, you know, the village chief gives them a tour around the village and explicitly calls out to start with all of these, like, well, this is the east path in and this is the west path in, and there's like a path through the mountains to the north, like, and here is what they all look like. And just to like set that up for the players a little bit, they won't tell the players what to do, but they mm-hmm. might be able to paint them a word picture.
Yeah,
you know, I'm thinking like, it's much more evocative to have the village elder like show you around the town, and then, you know, you describe the gate over the entrance to the village and the bridge. Like, that's going to be a much easier kind of mental image to interact with for the players. Mm-hmm. So I think there is some scope to like make sure you litter some options in there.
Yeah, I think you give some leads on there. You give an affordance, but you exactly. don't have to spell it out.
Yeah. Give them some interesting toys to play with without telling them the right way to use it. So if you put a bridge yep. in, you're not going to say, we should collapse the bridge, because maybe you want to use the bridge as a choke point. Maybe you want to hide under the bridge and like jump out and surprise them. Yep. There's all sorts of things that you can do with the bridge that aren't just the obvious thing.
The way the movie handles it, I think it's excellent in teaching some basic tactics as well, where they're not trying to close all pathways. They conspicuously leave one pathway open.
I had that written down.
It's a tactical choice to engage at that spot and divvy up the people who come in so that they're divided and can be conquered.
Yep. They were like, every castle needs a breach.
Yeah. Like, it's the intentional weak spot to draw attention to.
Which I thought, again, watching the movie, it's all very like different culture, but like it's all very Sun Tzu, the art of war. Like, you mm-hmm. set things up so that you engage the enemy on in a place where you're at advantage and they're at a disadvantage. Like, it's not like every entrance to the town, every angle of attack has to become a death trap, mm-hmm. right? It's like, actually, we're just going to blow up the bridge and now they can't get in over the bridge, and we're going to flood the fields and they can't get in over the fields, and that's going to force them to come in from a direction that we've decided in advance.
And then we invest lots of defense at this one spot.
Yeah, exactly. So that's...
It's very similar to tower defense games, where if you build a very large, weak maze, you're probably not going to win. Most of these games are built around having like a key point to defend at, and then you're funneling everything to maximize time around that one spot.
Right. So I was wondering, because obviously we have this front of mind because we've just watched the movie.
Mm-hmm.
I'm wondering how you would go about sort of prompting players to get into that mindset. Because if you come at this as a D&D player, you're like, bridge, okay, well, you know, we'll blow up the bridge when they're on it, and turn, like, that becomes a trap in quote marks in the D&D mm-hmm. sense, in it. It is something that is like triggered and does damage. So how do you get them thinking in that more strategic way where mm-hmm. it's about controlling territory and forcing them to engage on your terms and, you know, maintaining the element of surprise and all of these like very classical warfare-y things? Like, how do you put the players into that mindset coming in? Not that it's your job to necessarily tell them how to think, mm-hmm. but
this is a style, like a genre of game that will reward that play.
Exactly. And they're also coming in with a set of preconceptions already, mm-hmm. Which is that I think dungeon mentality where the word trap means a particular thing.
Yep. It means 3d6 damage triggered on a plate or something.
Exactly. So how do you get them into this mindset where they are thinking about controlling territory a bit more? And funnily enough, I did also have tower defense written down. I was like, maybe you just like make everyone play a few rounds of like desktop tower defense or something.
That's, I think, your it would homework. Help. I think there is scope to do that in session, though. And that's through providing ways for them to get information about what the bad guys, like what their strengths are. So if we're talking about like a strategy layer, to be able to make good strategic decisions, you need to know what your enemy's strengths and weaknesses are, and then build that into your defense.
And what your strengths and weaknesses are as well.
Yeah, exactly. Like, how can you leverage the things that you're really good at? In which case it's, you have a small elite squad and a large number of untrained people. So how can you best utilize them? So I think there's ways that you can feed information to the players, either like directly through encounters. You know, you're having this encounter and then suddenly there's a couple of musket shots from above and they all drop to the ground worried that they're going to get shot. And then that becomes a, okay, how do we, like what I want my players to be saying is, how can we get rid of that? How can we stop them from shooting us? I want to give my players enough information that they can always say, well, how do I stop that from happening?
Giving them information is one thing, but so much of it is like a mindset thing. Mm-hmm. And it's in like how they approach solving the problems. And I think there's a real risk that that players will try and get too clever.
Oh yeah, I definitely agree with that. But often I love that. Like, I love it when that happens because I want to see it fail in a spectacular way that develops this great story of their own making.
Mm.
And sometimes, very rarely, it doesn't and it all goes off. So how do we get the players in the mindset? I think it's very legitimate to be like, yeah, you should play a couple of tower defense games, or if you've got other games in your like shared library to play around with. One of my current addictions is a game called Mechabellum on Steam, which is like chess, but it's an auto battler, and all of your pieces are squads of mechs.
So and like nothing like chess at all.
It's like chess in that it is very much about piece placement and the areas of control that each unit can have. It's a fantastic game for this sort of mindset.
Yeah. I wonder if there's something like that that you could play like a tabletop version of that. What happens if I type tower defense board games into Google? But, you know, like that's kind of what I'm thinking. It's something you can play a really quick round of to kind of get in the...
in the zone for.
Yeah, into the headspace. And I think just break out of that headspace of dungeon-style traps a little bit. And more into the headspace of like funneling them here and denying them there, you know?
Yep. I really feel like that denial is the critical thing.
Yeah.
Because if you're playing this like straight 5e type thing where, oh yeah, you got a bunch of bandits on horseback coming in, the logfall trap falls and hits them for 4d6 damage, doesn't stop them from being on horses. Like, that needs to be something that's explicitly negotiated, that if you set up this type of trap, this is the outcome you would expect if it goes off.
Mm.
So it's not just you have your one shot to do X number of damage. It's you have your shot to change the way the bad guys can fight.
Mm.
So I feel like we've got our anchors down pat. We've got a couple optional extras, like I might have some things up my sleeve about how they might launch a like surprise attack or do a scouting mission or going outside and changing something that's not in the immediate vicinity in the defense of the town. It's like some sort of push your luck, go out and do a thing type mission, and maybe a few social encounters on the inside as well.
I reckon that structure is worth spending a little bit of time on, actually, because I think more so than the content, that kind of story structure or that session structure is kind of what gives this genre its, like, it's what makes it work. So I think it is kind of pretty important that, you know, we mentioned that the movie very much has like three phases. We've kind of discussed maybe we want to bring that down to two because we don't necessarily need to get the party together.
Mm-hmm.
We've talked a little bit about the preparing the village kind of phase, but I think that second half of the game, the battle half, it's not just an open slather. It actually has some internal structure in mm-hmm. the film as well. It's not just like a 2 hour long fight scene or an hour long fight scene. Like, it has ebbs and flows, and it kind of,
it goes in waves.
Exactly. It is literally waves. So there is a first wave and a second wave and a third wave. And they get,
after each one, we have that check-in moment where Kanbei is crossing off the number of bad guys they have on their map.
Exactly. Which I think would be a really cool thing to include somehow if you can. Like, I saw that and I'm like, yep, that's going in the game. There's going to be little like cross boxes on the map. And it's not breaking immersion because they did it in the movie.
Yeah, as a tool for the audience to understand what's going on, it works seamlessly in the fiction as well.
Yeah, and the movie itself is almost a little bit gamey to the point where he points out that it's not a game. yeah.
Thus but resolving the problem.
I think the fact that attack phase has some internal structure is really important too. So the first wave is like testing the defenses and the enemy figures out what has been done.
They maybe send some scouts.
The first wave is easier. The second wave is harder. The third wave is like the most desperate. The first wave, they're kind of maybe only under attack on one front. And then later waves, they're under attack on more and more fronts as things sort of get out of control.
There's a time duration to this battle in that it happens like over 2 days, which means there's a nighttime raid.
Yep. So again, there's between each of these waves, there's some downtime, which is really important for kind of shoring up the defenses and also having some like character moments. And then you have these like almost optional extras, which you kind of touched on before, these little like bonus things, like they go out on a raid and raid the bad guys, or they do a scouting run, or there's a nighttime or a surprise attack. There's, you know, some kind of betrayal or fuck up from the villagers that causes a problem. That is actually one thing I was genuinely surprised was not a trope that came from this movie. Like, I was genuinely expecting one of the villagers to be a traitor. And I was like, oh no, if we just let them in, they'll be, you know, they'll be kind to us.
Followed by the classic scene of them realizing their mistake and saying, what have I done? Which is one of my most hated movie moments.
I mean, yeah, but also I think you could throw that one in there. So I'm thinking almost of this structure of like, there is an attack wave and then there's some downtime and then there's maybe these like little bonus things that can happen before the next attack wave. And then you have another attack that's more intense than the last. You have some more downtime. You have the option for another little like bonus. And then you have your final battle. But there's kind of this like internal structure to the combat, the attack half of the movie that is quite sort of amenable to mix and matching and customizing. Mm-hmm. And that also gives a very satisfying like ebb and flow.
Yeah, it gives real nice like high intensity moments with low intensity social encounters.
Exactly. So again, if I bring it back to like what would I be disappointed if I didn't get, if we did all of this prep and then there was just like one big combat and the game was over, like, disappointing. To be a satisfying story, it has to be this ebby, flowy, wavy kind of structure to the final attack. It can't just be one big slog.
All right. This is a really good time, I think, to segue into what are you actually prepping?
Let's do
it. As the GM, what are you doing at the table? We've touched on some really strong points already that come straight out of the anchors. So like, A, I'm prepping a map. I got some form of spatial layout.
Oh, for sure.
I'm prepping a couple of characters that represent the villagers. They're all tied thematically to the nature of this town, the quintessential thing that makes it. They are the holders of a resource in the movie. It's food. Literally just as basic as food. It could be anything else, though. It could be they have like some sort of magical artifact that they've built the town around.
And I think that's why this thing has been adapted so many times. It's like, yeah, look,
this framework is so flexible.
Maybe they're on a space station and there's only three wormholes into the system, right? Like, the actual structure of the story is completely independent of
the content,
the fluff, the content.
Yeah. But at any rate, we've got a reason for them to be attacked.
Yes. And I think concrete reasons are better than abstract reasons in this case.
The reason why we think Seven Samurai works so well is because it's such a local story, which means that the reasons should also be quite local. It's like, oh yeah, they've got a barley harvest that's going to be ready in 3 weeks. Bad guys need food. That's it. That's the story right there.
Just not.
Got a premise.
Just cannot imagine being that excited about barley.
So, regardless of it's barley or if it's mineral vein or something like that, their village has the thing. The bad guys want the thing. So what are we going to prep for the bad guys? I'm going to want to have a couple different types of unit that's attacking. Mm-hmm. In the film, we've got there's a couple dudes who are archers. There's a couple dudes with muskets, literally three, I think. There's dudes on horseback. There's dudes on foot. And like, some of the dudes on horseback are heavily armored. They look like samurai gone rogue. And some of the dudes don't at all. They don't have the fancy armor. They all respond in the same way, but their abilities are quite different. And I think that's important, because if everyone's the same, you're not going to end up with nuanced strategic decisions.
Yeah, exactly. So just making it so that the strengths that these guys have are kind of either hitting the players where they're weak deliberately, or are like completely orthogonal to what the players have experience with, and so the players need to think laterally to try and counter that. For example, in the movie, being a really, really good samurai in one-on-one combat doesn't necessarily prepare you for fighting a lot of individual bad guys, but it's also not a disadvantage. It's just that, like, that's not necessarily what you're set up for, so you have to try and figure out how to make that situation be to your advantage, which is to have them coming at you one-on-one.
It'd be like in D&D, sending your rogue in to fight five dudes at once. It's just a terrible choice.
Yep.
But if you can funnel them in one-on-one, they're going to absolutely destroy them.
Exactly. So it's something that the players can't just say, like, well, I have a direct counter for that, really, is what I'm getting at.
Yep. In the movie, I absolutely loved the way that Kikuchiyo disguises himself to look like one of the bad guys and then sidles right up to one of the dudes with a musket who's overlooking the town.
And just has a chat.
Doesn't just go for him. They sit down, they have a little chat until the guy realizes he's actually one of the village's defenders.
Yep.
And then they, through that encounter, he denies them the musket. Kikuchiyo uses his ingenuity to overcome the problem that is the strength that these bad guys have.
Yeah. So, yeah, I think we're prepping moreover than getting into the nitty-gritty and prepping, like, specific baddies. We're sort of starting at the higher level and prepping, like, what are the advantages that we want the baddies to have? And kind of working down from there so that they make for interesting challenges for the players.
At the start, I think I'd just be using some real simple tags for it. So I'd be like, these guys move fast. These guys shoot far. And like, you could even come up with this without any flavor attached to it and then stick it in there afterwards. So it's like, they move fast. Is that because they're on horseback? Is it because they're giant salamander people? And the way they wiggle their lower body just makes them go real fast.
That's so specific.
It just came to me.
So we're prepping our village map. We're prepping our bad guys. What else are we coming in there with a little collection of?
We've got our local flavor NPCs, which is nice and important. And I think I'd also throw down, like, real vague couple of opportunities for those push your luck, go outside the defense of the village kind of moments. So, like, where do these bad guys bunker down? What resources do they have? Do they have torches? Do they have limited food? Like, what strategic weakness is there? So I want to have a rough idea of what it might be. And then I want to shape that up when the players engage with it.
by a similar token, I think having the battle phase not just be attack, rest, attack, rest, attack, rest is like quite important. Because it's almost like there's a slot, right? It's like a phase. If they choose not to use their bonus action, right? Then I would have some things that would happen in those if the players chose not to do something. So like if they choose not to go out on a counter attack.
It might be something like, a villager opens the gate or a villager makes a hole in the wall.
Yeah. So if the players are not putting anything in that slot, that's another thing that I would prep as DM. I would prep some things to happen in that part of the cycle.
Like the interesting choice around that from the player perspective then would have to be, do we not do anything and recuperate? Like there has to be a tangible benefit to not doing anything, but the cost is some event will occur versus do we take charge of the event?
Yeah. Yeah, that's like, an interesting way of thinking about it.
Yeah, like I think there's a way that you could sit down and really heavily number this out and be like, all right, so there's going to be like three phases. They're going to have resources in these areas. Time is a resource. Lamp oil is a resource. Food is a resource. They're going to spend those resources over here and just like really calculate out how much they're expending each wave versus how much they could, you know, recuperate each wave.
Is that fun though?
No, that's a board game. I don't want to do it that way.
I don't even think that's a board game. I think when you get down to that level of granularity, it's like you are now just playing Age of Empires.
Yeah, you're playing boring Age of Empires.
Yeah.
So I think I would want to keep things a bit lighter than that, but I think you would want to have some form of like tracker for morale and doing nothing is the chance for people to sit around, have chats, restore morale.
Yeah, break out the sake.
Yep, exactly. I think that's pretty much all I need to get this on the go.
Yeah, I think probably the last thing I would add is you know, I think this is going to be a game that pivots really heavily on everybody sitting around a map. Mm-hmm. And so just in terms of physical prep, I would be getting some like butcher's paper or a whiteboard that can sit flat or something. Like
honestly, I love butcher's paper more. Like I don't want it to be a non-permanent surface because I want them to draw over the top of things and that's the story. Like
that
butcher's paper is the physical record of the story that occurred.
I like that a lot too. It's almost a little bit far out. What is it? The game with the villagers.
Oh, yeah. Cards. Carcassonne.
No. Dipshit. A Quiet Year.
Oh, yes, yes, yes.
Where they're like drawing things on the map as they go. Look, I think it kind of depends. I'd be bringing whatever's easiest. I know this is a like fairly standard game mastering tool.
Oh, yeah, maybe. But a lot of people have joined that mostly only play online. So
yes.
Genuinely, maybe not.
And I think that's kind of what I'm trying to get at is that, you know, a lot of the online virtual tabletops are very good these days, but I don't think they do what we need here because they're very geared around like moving your token around and being on a grid. If you were going to do this online, I would almost, rather than using a VTT, I would almost like drop everybody into the Zoom whiteboard.
Yep.
Like a freeform whiteboard app is going to be much more effective for this than a VTT, I think.
Mm-hmm. I have some thoughts on that when we get to the would you run this in 5e section as well.
Ooh, spicy. Forward sizzle. Yeah,
this is a great time, I think, to say what system would you run this in?
Yeah, I'm sure you have opinions about this. Let me guess. Is it Blades in the Dark?
Yep. It 100% is, because I think all the elements that we've just described there are really effective in a Forge in the Dark system. We've got our, like, heat can be represented as, like, intensity of the attacks that are building over time. We've got, like, downtime activities in between scores, which are, like, the defense moments. And there's one mechanic that I really quite like here. One thing that I would be very disappointed in as a player would be I've built this trap, or I've built this defense, like the log trap to go off, or I've got a bunch of boulders that are in a pass and I can push them down at a specific moment, and nobody goes that way.
Mm.
And so it's just that that effort is expended and then never used. And this is built into Blades really effectively through flashback mechanics. We can flash back and only put the traps in the places that the bad guys are going to go.
Mm.
So I think this is a really effective way of maximizing time that's not spent planning in what could be potentially really heavy planning game.
Yeah, I do think it's interesting that unlike, for example, a heist where you see the flashbacks in the fiction, Seven Samurai has no flashbacks. So it is a little bit of a break from the fiction. And I don't know what that necessarily does to your vibe. I would be interested to try it. But I think it's in Blades for a reason, because again, Blades is built around these like, or imagined with this heisty kind of mechanic in mind. That's another genre which pivots very heavily on making a plan and then executing it. It's just that the media that we see around that usually actually includes the flashbacks. I don't think they won't work here. I would be curious to see how it affects the kind of vibe at the table, because I think that would make it feel heistier, and I think it makes the players feel, you know how everyone in a heist is kind of a smart ass?
Yeah, like the sarcastic ass samurai.
I mean,
when I was watching this, my first thought was straight up like, oh yeah, Kanbei is the mastermind. Like, he's sitting there pulling the strings and maneuvering all of the players on the grand scale. We could easily recut this film to be just flashbacks from Kanbei, and then those are the things that are occurring to the bad guys as they rush in.
Yeah, but I think that has a very different feel.
Narrative feel, because that scenario,
it makes Kanbei feel very clever.
Yes.
And as it is in the film, he feels wise.
I see what you're...
Right? I feel like flashbacks encourage your players to come up with very clever solutions in the moment. And what we actually see in the film is very simple solutions that they know are going to work. Right? Like, yes, it's not an elaborate log trap over the bridge that may or may not get triggered. It's we will destroy the bridge, and the bridge will no longer be an option for people to enter. And we know that's going to come into play because you have destroyed the bridge, and that's one less front for you to guard. And like, that's always going to be effective. So I feel like what I'm trying to get at here is like, I feel like flashbacks reward clever behavior in the moment, which is fine if that's what you're going for. But I feel like the thing foresight that we actually see in the film is these like simple but effective moments of planning and foresight, rather than this like smart arsey retconning.
I can respect that. I can definitely see like the difference in vibe
in
the way that you play that out.
And a difference in like a thing that I kind of want from a player is so, to be rewarded for actually thinking ahead and having a strategy. And flashbacks, they don't preclude that, but they also don't give me that satisfaction of saying like, we actually set this thing up and it actually paid off.
Yeah. I think there's a lot to be said about the reward that you get from when the plan executes.
And it is, it's exactly the same stuff we were kind of talking about before, right? It's like, how do you get the players into the mindset of thinking of a simple plan that will actually work versus trying to come up with these elaborate schemes that may not only work, but may not come into play. I think, look, I would be really interested to see how flashbacks play out. Even in terms of pacing, like having spent so long talking about like, hey, we want this ebb and flow structure of like, prepare, attack,
I'm coming around,
bonus, prepare, attack, bonus. I just wonder if there's a way that you can combine the flashback version of plan making with an actual plan.
I think there is. If you give the actual plan just like a slight mechanical discount. It's like if we were like straight plays mechanics, let's say stress is the resource that's expended here. If you build the thing in time in the session, then you're consuming time, but you don't consume stress. But if you want to flashback, it's a stress per flashback to build the thing, and you have to have the time left over.
Yeah.
It's like there's an opportunity cost to leaving it till later.
Yeah, that could work.
I'm coming around, but I think it's still an interesting space to explore. And maybe I will.
Maybe we start with Forged in the Dark as a set of tools and like rip some bits out and glom some bits on rather than just running straight.
Yeah, blades. No, I always agree with that as well. I think maybe it's like this fits. It's a square peg with rounded edges. You know, it's like 75% this fits into what already exists there. Maybe with a little bit of tweaking.
Mm.
Let's spend some time in the lab. what would you run it in?
I think you could run it in anything. And I think the fact that the structure is kind of independent of the system means that it would be a good one to drop into an existing campaign.
Yep, I agree with that.
The fact that it doesn't actually need a lot of mechanical bells and whistles to make it fun.
Yeah.
Means that it's a really good fit for an existing campaign. And that means that you can kind of cut the whole first third of the movie out because the players already know each other and they're already working together as a party.
Yeah. Which I think is the least interesting part of the role-playing session.
It's an integral part of the movie, but it's not a fun part of the game.
Great time to segue. So if you were to run this in 5e, would you? The answer, I think, is yes, you actually really can. But what would you prepare for differently? And I have some strong thoughts on this from the meta level and from the like encounter balance level as well.
So here's one for you. Maybe I wouldn't run it in 5e. Maybe I would run it in 4e. And the
bold
reason
takes.
Yeah, hot takes. There's a couple of bits from 4e that I would really enjoy using in this. And one of them is skill challenges, which is that idea of a like, there's a whole toolkit in 4e for putting level-appropriate non-combat challenges in, which is basically this many skill check successes before this many skill check failures with a list of skills that are applicable so that the players can bring whatever approach they want to it. And they all kind of contribute to the successes as a party. And so I think skill challenges work really well for your like setting up the defenses. And the other thing that I think really is worth borrowing back from 4e is the concept of minions, which are enemies with one hit point. So they go down after one hit. No matter what you do, if you succeed on your attack roll, they go down. The flip side of that is that they tend to have quite a high damage output, and so getting like mobbed by them can be quite deadly.
Devastating.
I think 5e bad guys can often feel like a food that is the same texture the whole way through. I've been listening to this food podcast recently. It's the one where the guy designs his own pasta shape.
Oh yeah.
It's the podcast is The Sporkful, the series is Mission Impastable.
Oh, that's gold. that's just beautiful comedy right there.
But a thing that they talk about in the like food prep world is this idea of dynamic contrast. So like this idea that in a perfect pasta shape, some parts of the pasta should be like soft and
al dente
and supple, and some should be, yeah, firm and al dente. And actually the most satisfying shapes have a little bit of both. They're like soft around the edges and firmer in the middle. And so you design your shape to like encourage them to cook in that way. And I think you want the same thing from your enemies in this, right? You want dynamic contrast. You want some of them to be hard hitting but to go down easy, and you want some of them to be absolute tanks and will just sit there, and you want some of them to be fast and some of them to be slow. And I just think 4e did a better job at that.
So your really bold take, which you once chastised me for on how would you run this in 5e, is you would run this in 4e. If I might offer a contrasting opinion.
Yep.
if you're not opposed to third-party supplements, MCDM did release a new book on monsters that the Kickstarter has recently been fulfilled. And their whole take is trying to make it more like that. Like, Matt Colville comes from a very strong 4E gaming background, and they've assigned roles to the monsters and they've given them abilities to fit those roles. And it is much more texture than what you find in the 5E basic monster manual, where like 2/3 of things are, it has a natural weapon attack and a bag of hit points.
Yeah.
Go nuts. So yes, I think it can be done in 5E. The thing that concerns me more greatly is the power level of the players. I would run this at level 5 tops, just when they get access to their third level spells and their second attacks, and they are significantly better than the average peasant. You know, when your marshals are going in there making their one attack per round at level 4, I don't think that they can significantly influence the battle enough. I don't think they're protagonist enough.
I think you're right. And I think that, like, flip side of that is you don't want them to be too high level, because then they are...
Yep, they can annihilate
armies. I mean, at that
armies.
Point, you're not doing Seven Samurai, you're doing the Battle of Helm's Deep, right? Like,
yep.
Probably not even Helm's Deep. This is probably more like Pelennor Fields.
Yeah.
Like, outside Minas Tirith.
Over the top, too much damage.
Fucking elephants and ghost armies and shit.
Yeah.
That's high level D&D.
I would keep this as like a, like, just on the cusp of tier 2 level of play for 5e.
Yeah, and I think that's a good spot to, like, drop it into your campaign. Doing it as campaign play has so much potential as well, because there's so many ways that this could hook into the rest of the world.
Because after you've played 4 or 5 sessions in the same town, defending them from attacks and, like, tending to their wounded, you're going to have some really tight bonds to this location.
I mean, heck, after 2.5 hours, I was like, man, I fucking hate Yohei. He sucks. He's got a real annoying face. And then, like, 20 minutes later, they killed Yohei. I was like, no!
You can't do that.
He's annoying, but he was my annoying dude, you know? Like, you can't kill him. And that's what I want for the players, right? Like, I want them to absolutely... find one of these NPCs, like, fucking insufferable, and then I want them to be sad when he dies.
Exactly right. I'd never script someone to die, but I would put them in danger and see what happens.
Yeah, and the ones that survive are the ones that you then pull back into the campaign at a later date, and, like, maybe they feel good that the village survived, maybe they feel bad that the players let so many of their, you know, friends and family die. Like, there's just so many opportunities to do sequel fodder.
Yes.
Right.
Cool. So would you run it?
Yeah, I would.
Absolutely. I don't think there's any need for discussion. I think this is just such a great structure. So many rich story opportunities to come out of it. Lots of opportunities for your players to feel like protagonists.
I think compared with some of the stuff that we have talked about on the show, this is actually something that I am likely to run at some point in the future. Like, this will find its way into a campaign that is happening at some point. It's something that's very amenable to D&D. I'm trying to get into doing some, like, DMing for strangers down at, like, meetups.
How exciting.
I know. It's something that's going to fit quite well into that, right? Because it's nice and self-contained. It doesn't require people to learn a new system. So, not only would I run it, I think it's pretty likely that, having developed this kind of structure, it's one that I will just keep in my back pocket for a nice little drop-in scenario.
Absolutely. All right. Well, I think we're good.
I think we might be done. That's it. We've solved Seven Samurai.
The first people to ever do that.
The first people to ever adapt Seven Samurai into anything, and you've been along for the ride.
You've been right here with us. Playtonix. That's PlayTonics.net. You can find our podcast wherever the podcast you just listened to was on.
If you enjoyed the show, please send it to your dungeon master or your game master. Not necessarily like passive aggressively, just regular aggressively. No, send it to your dungeon master. If you are a dungeon master, send it to one of your dungeon master or game master friends. Because the whole reason we are doing this is because we want for there to be more interestingly structured, interestingly thought out games in the world. I think that's it. I think that's all the important bits. I think we could be done.
Thanks, team. Love you. Bye.
Love you. Bye.
Do I disconnect from the recording now?
I don't know. Are you going to say something funny right at the end again?
I don't think so.
Okay, yeah, now we can disconnect from the recording. The window for funny end of show comments has now closed.